Act 5. 113. Exterior. The Little Tall Island. Town Hall. Night. The wind is still blowing the snow around, but the stuff falling from the sky has stopped. The storm of the century, Mother Nature's version anyway, has ended. 114. Exterior. The sky. Night. The clouds have begun to tatter and pull apart. This time, when the full moon appears, it remains in view. 115. Interior, the town meeting hall, from the corridor. We're looking in through the glass doors, and running across the bottom of our view like a super on a newscast is that motto, "Let us trust in God and each other." We can see Robbie Beals getting to his feet, his hair still mussed from hiding under the table, and crossing slowly toward the podium. 116. Omit. 117. Interior, the town meeting hall. Night. The director will shot block the following as he/she desires, but it should play almost as one big master, which is how it's mostly written. Robbie reaches the podium and looks out over the silent, waiting audience. Below him, on the first bench, Mike remains seated, but thrums almost visibly like a high-tension wire. Hatch sits on one side of him and Molly on the other. Mike is holding her hand, and she is looking at him anxiously. Sitting behind him on the next bench are Lucien, Sonny, Alex, and Johnny, self-appointed sergeants-at-arms. If Mike tries to interfere with the decision-making process, they will restrain him. At the rear of the room, where the kids are sleeping, the circle of adults has grown. Ursula has joined Tavia near Sally Godso. Both Andy and Jill are with Harry. Jack has joined Angie to be close to Buster. Although when Jack tries to put an arm around his wife, Angie dips her shoulders and slips away from his touch.
Jackie, you got some splainin' to do, as Ricky Ricardo might have said.
Melinda is sitting by Pippa, and next to her, Sandra is sitting by Dawn. Carla and Henry Bright sit at the foot of Frank's cot, holding hands. Linda St. Pierre is with Heidi. The attention of all the parents is not on their sleeping children, however, but on Robbie, the self-appointed moderator, and on their fellow islanders who will decide the fate of their children. Making a tremendous effort to get his act together, Robbie looks beneath the podium and brings out a gavel, old and heavy, a relic that has been handed down from the 17th century. Robbie looks at it for a moment as if he's never seen it before, then brings it down with a hard banging sound. Several people jump. Robbie.
I call the meeting to order. I think it'll be best if we deal with this matter the way we would any other piece of town business. After all, that's what it is, isn't it? Town business.
Silence and strained faces greet this. Mike looks as if he would like to respond, but doesn't. Molly continues to look at her husband anxiously and to caress his hand, which is tightly, painfully, one would think, enfolding hers. Robbie.
Any objection to that?
Silence. Robbie brings the gavel down again. Whack. And once again, people jump. Not the kids, though. They are deeply asleep again, or comatose. Robbie.
The item on the floor is whether or not to give this thing that's come among us, one of our children. He says he'll go away if we give him what he wants, and tell us all, the kids included, if we don't. Have I stated it fairly?
Silence. Robbie.
All right. How say you then, Little Tall? Will you speak of this?
Silence. Then Cal Freeze gets slowly to his feet. He looks around at his fellow islanders. Cal.
I don't see what choice we have. If we believe, he can do what he says he can do.
Roberta Coyne.
Do you believe him?
Cal.
First thing I ask myself, and, yeah, I do. I've seen enough to convince me. I think we either give him what he wants or he'll take everything we have, including our kids.
Cal sits down. Robbie.
Roberta Coyne's got a good point, though. How many of you think Linoge is telling the truth, that he can and will wipe out everyone on the island if we go against him?
Silence. They all believe it, but no one wants to be first to hoist his or her hand. Stella Bissonette.
We all had the same dream,
And they weren't regular dreams, I know that. We all know that. He's given us fair warning. She raises her hand.
Bert Soames. There's nothing fair about it, but...
One of Bert's arms is in a makeshift sling, but he raises his unhurt one in the air. Others follow suit, at first just a few, then more, then almost all of them. Hatch and Molly are among the last to raise their hands. Only Mike sits grimly where he is, keeping the hand Molly's not holding in his lap. Molly, low, to Mike.
It's not a question of what we're going to do, Mike. Not yet. It's just whether or not we believe.
Mike, I know what the question is. And once we start down this road, every step gets easier. I know that, too. Robbie, lowering his own hand.
All right. I guess we believe him. That's one issue out of the way. Now, if there's any discussion of the main question...
Mike, to his feet. I have something to say. Robbie.
That's fine. You're a taxpayer, sure enough. Have on.
Mike walks slowly up the stairs to the stage. Molly watches, apprehensively. Mike doesn't bother with the podium. He simply turns to his fellow islanders. We take several beats to focus and build tension as he thinks about how to begin. Mike. No, he's not a man. I didn't vote, but I agree with that just the same. I've seen what he did to Martha Clarendon, what he did to Peter Godso, what he's done to our kids. And I don't believe he's a man. I had the same dreams that you had, and I understand the reality of what he's threatening as well as you do. Better, maybe. I'm your constable, the man you elected to enforce your laws. But folks, we don't give our kids away to thugs. Do you understand that? We don't give away our children. At the back of the room, where the children are, Andy Robichaud steps forward. Andy.
What's the choice, then? What do we do? What can we do?
A deep murmur of agreement greets this, and Mike is troubled. We can see that, because the only answer he has makes no sense. It has only the virtue of being right. Mike. Stand against him, side by side and shoulder to shoulder. Tell him no, in one voice. Do what it says on the door we use to get in here. Trust in God and each other. And then, maybe, he goes away. The way storms always do when they've blown themselves out. Orv Boucher stands.
And if he starts pointing his cane around, what then? What about when we start to drop like flies on a windowsill?
Murmur of agreement is louder. Reverend Bob Riggins stands.
Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's. You said that to me yourself, Michael, not an hour ago. Book of Matthew.
Mike.
Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savorest not the things that be of God.
Book of Mark. Looks around.
Folks, if we give up a child, one of our own, how will we live with each other, even if he lets us live?
Robbie.
Very well, that's how.
Mike turns to look at him, stunned. At the back of the room, Jack Carver comes forward to the head of the center aisle. When he speaks, Mike turns back that way. He's being bombarded from all directions.
Jack. We've all got things to live with, Mike. Or maybe you're different.
That hits home. We see Mike remembering. He addresses Jack and all of them. Mike.
No, I'm no different. But this isn't like trying to live with a test you cheated on or a one-night stand or the memory of somebody you hurt when you were drunk and in an ugly frame of mind. This is a child. Don't you understand that, Jack?
He's maybe getting to them. Then Robbie speaks up.
Robbie. Suppose you're right about being able to send him away. Suppose we just put our arms around each other, gather our will, and give out a big collective no. Suppose we do that and he just disappears, goes back to wherever he came from.
Mike looks at him warily, waiting for the hook.
Robbie. You saw our children. I don't know what he's actually done with them, but I have no doubt that flying high over the earth is an accurate representation of it. They can fall. I believe that. All he has to do is wave that cane of his and they fall. How do we live with ourselves if that happens?
Do we tell ourselves that we killed all eight of them because we were too good, too holy to sacrifice one of them?
Mike, he could be bluffing. Melinda, sharp, unfriendly.
He's not, Michael, and you know it. You saw it.
Tavia Godso comes hesitantly forward to the head of the center aisle, which seems to be the preferred speaking position for the islanders. She talks hesitantly at first, then with growing confidence. Tavia.
You speak as though he were going to kill the child, Michael. As though it were some kind of human sacrifice. It sounds more like an adoption to me.
She looks around, smiling tentatively. If we have to do this, let's make the best of it. Let's look on the bright side. Jonas. And a long life as well. Pause. If you believe him, that is. And after seeing him, Actually, I guess I do. Murmurs of agreement and approval. Mike. Benoge beat Martha Clarendon to death with his cane, knocked the eyes right out of her head. We're debating whether or not to give a child to a monster. Silence greets this. Folks drop their eyes to the floor, cheeks red, ashamed. Reverend Bob Riggins sits down again. His wife puts a hand on his arm and looks at Mike resentfully. Henry Bright.
Maybe that's so, but what about the rest of the kids? Do we say no and then watch them die right in front of us?
Kirk.
Yeah, Mike. What happened to the good of the most?
Mike has no real answer for this.
Mike. He could be bluffing about the kids, too. Satan's the father of lies, and this guy has got to be a close relation.
Joel Robichaud, shrill and angry.
Is that a risk you want to take? Fine, but take it with your son, not mine.
Linda St. Pierre.
My sentiments exactly.
Henry Bright.
You want to know the worst thing I can think of, Michael? Suppose you're half right. Suppose we live and they die.
Points to the kids.
How will we look at each other then? How will we live with each other then?
Jack.
And how would we ever live with you?
Ugly assenting murmurs to this. Jack, the gay basher, goes back to his sleeping little boy and sits down beside him. Mike has no real answer for this, either. We can see him floundering for one and not finding it. Robbie looks at the clock. It's 9:20. Robbie.
He said half an hour. That leaves us 10 minutes.
Mike. We can't do this.
Can't you see? Don't you understand? We can't allow him to...
Sonny. Not unkindly.
I think we've heard your side of it, Mike. Take a seat, why don't you?
Mike looks at them helplessly. He's not stupid. He can see which way the wind is blowing.
Mike, you need to think about this, folks. You need to think about it very carefully.
He goes back down the steps and sits beside Molly. He takes her hand. She lets him hold it for a second or two, then draws it away. Molly,
I want to sit with Ralphie, Mike.
She gets up and goes down the center aisle to where the kids are sleeping on their cots. She disappears into the circle of parents without a look back. Robbie.
Do you have more, folks? What's your pleasure?
A moment of silence. Ursula steps forward.
God help us, but let's give him what he wants. Give him what he wants and send him on his way. I don't care about my life, but the children, even if it's Sally... Better she should live with a bad man than die.
She looks around, weeping.
My God, Michael Anderson, where's your heart? They're children. We can't let him kill the children.
She goes back to the kids. Mike, meanwhile, is being isolated in a circle of hostile eyes. Robbie glances at the clock.
Anyone else?
Mike starts to get up. Hatch puts his hand on his arm and squeezes. When Mike looks at him, surprised and questioning, Hatch gives a tiny shake of the head. Stop, that small head shake says. You've done all you can do. Mike shakes him off and stands up again. He doesn't use stage this time, but addresses his fellow islanders from where he is. Mike, don't, please. The Andersons go back to 1735 here on Little Tall. I ask you as an islander, and as Ralphie Anderson's father, don't do this. Don't give in to this.
Pause.
This is damnation.
He looks around desperately. None of them, not even his own wife, will meet his eyes. Silence descends again. It's broken only by the whine of the wind outside and the tick of the regulator clock. Mike. All right. I move to restrict the vote. Let the parents vote and the parents only. They're all residents. Linda St. Pierre.
No, that's not fair.
She touches her sleeping daughter's brow with gentle love. Linda St. Pierre.
I've raised her by myself.
Oh, with plenty of help from folks on the island, including you and your wife, Mike. But mostly by myself. I shouldn't have to make a decision like this all by myself.
What's a community for if it isn't to help people when something terrible happens, when none of the choices look good?
Andy, couldn't have said it better myself, Lynn.
Mike.
But.
Many voices.
Sit down. Call the question. Let's vote.
Etc. Robbie.
Well, someone moved the question of who can vote. It's probably not parliamentary, but we have to move on. I'd prefer to hear from one of the parents.
A moment of tense silence, then Melinda Hatcher.
I move everybody votes.
Carla Bright.
I second it.
Mike.
This isn't.
Angie.
Shut up. You've had your say, now just shut up.
Robbie.
It's been moved and seconded that everyone be allowed to vote on whether or not to give Mr. Lenoge what he has demanded. Those in favor?
Every hand goes up except for Mike's. He sees that Molly has also raised her hand, sees she won't look at him, and something in him dies a little. Robbie.
Those opposed?
Not a single hand goes up. Mike simply sits in the front row, his head dropped. Robbie whacks the gavel.
The motion carries.
Tess Marchant.
Call the question, Robbie Beals. The real question.
118. Interior, the basement, with Lenoge. He looks up at the ceiling, eyes gleaming in the gloom. They're going to vote, and he knows it. 119. Interior, resume, town meeting hall, night. Joanna.
For God's sake, let's vote and have done.
Mike, my son isn't a part of this. Let's understand that, all right? He's not a part of this obscenity. Molly.
Yes, he is.
Utter silence greets this. Mike stands up and looks unbelievingly at his wife. They face each other that way across the length of the meeting hall. Molly.
We've never shirked our duty, Michael. We've taken part in all the life of this island, and we'll take part in this.
Mike. You don't mean it.
You can't mean it.
Molly.
I do.
Mike.
It's insane.
Molly.
Maybe. But it's not an insanity we made. Michael.
Mike. I'm leaving. Screw this. Screw all of you. I'm taking my son and leaving. He gets about three steps before the self-appointed sergeants-at-arms grab him and yank him back to his seat. Molly sees Mike struggling, sees how rough they're being. They don't like his disapproval of this highly questionable decision, and runs down the aisle toward him. Mike.
Hatch, help me.
But Hatch turns away, face flushing with embarrassment, and when Mike lunges in his direction, Lucien smashes him in the nose. Blood flows. Molly.
Stop it. Stop hurting him. Mike, are you all right? Are you?
Mike, get away from me.
You want to do it before I lose control of myself and spit in your face.
She takes a step back from him, eyes huge and shocked. Molly.
Mike, if you'd only see, this isn't our decision to make alone. This affects the whole town.
Mike, I know it does. What else have I been saying? Get away from me, Molly. She backs away, grieving and sorrowful. Sonny Brodigan hands Mike a handkerchief. Mike.
You can let go. I'll sit.
They let go, but warily. On the podium, Robbie looks on with unmistakable satisfaction. This may be a bad situation, his face says, but at least our self-righteous prick of a constable is taking a face washing, and that's something. Molly, meanwhile, backs away from Mike, who won't look at her. Her face twists and crumples. Weeping, she walks toward the back of the room. People sitting on the aisle pat her hands and whisper comforts and encouragements as she goes. That's all right, dear. He'll come around. You're doing the right thing. At the back of the room, Melinda, Jill, and Linda St. Pierre enfold her. Hatch slides close to Mike, almost humming with shame. Hatch. Mike, I... Mike doesn't look at him. Shut up. Get away from me. Hatch. When you've had a chance to think about it, you'll understand. You'll come around. It's the only thing we can do. What else is there? Die for a principle? Every one of us? Including those who are too young to understand why they're dying? You need to think about it. Mike at last looks up. Mike. And if it's Pippa that Linoge ends up taking? A long silence as Hatch thinks. Then he meets Mike's eyes. Hatch. I'll tell myself she died as an infant. That it was a crib death. Something no one could help or foresee. And I'll believe it. Melly and me will both believe it. Robbie hammers on the podium some more with the gavel. Robbie.
Oye, oye. This question has been called. Do we or do we not give Mr. Linoge what he has asked for, pursuant to his promise that he will leave us in peace? How say you, little tall? Those in favor signify in the usual way.
There is a moment of breathless silence, and then, at the back of the room, Andy Robichaud raises his hand. Andy.
I'm Harry's father, and I vote yes.
Jill Robichaud.
I'm his mother, and so do I.
Henry.
Carla and I vote yes.
Linda St. Pierre raises her hand, so does Sandra Beals, and at the podium, Robbie raises his. Melinda raises her hand.
Yes, we have no choice.
Hatch.
No choice.
He raises his hand. Ursula.
I vote yes. It's the only way.
She raises her hand, and so does Tavia.
Jack.
Got to.
Up goes his hand. Angela takes a long, loving look at the sleeping Buster, then raises her own. The eyes of everyone in the room turn to Molly. She kneels, kisses Ralphie on the ferry saddle on his nose, then rises to her feet. She speaks to them all, but in a way she speaks only to Mike, her face pleading for understanding. Molly.
To lose one in life is better than to lose them all in death. I vote yes.
She raises her hand. Soon, other hands go up. The camera ranges among all the folks we have come to know, watching as every hand goes up, save one. Robbie draws the moment out, looking at the forest of raised arms and solemn faces. To give these people the credit they're due, they have made a terrible decision and know it. Robbie, soft.
Those opposed.
The raised hands go down. Mike, still looking at the floor, hoists his hand high in the air. Robbie.
I count all in favor save one. The motion is carried.
120. Interior. The regulator clock. Close up. The minute hand reaches 9:30 and the clock chimes once. 121. Interior. Resume. Town meeting hall. Night. The door is open. Linoge steps in, his cane in one hand, the small chamois bag in the other. Linoge.
Folks, have you reached your decision?
Robbie.
Yes. We voted in favor.
Linoge.
Excellent.
He walks along the back row, then pauses when he reaches the center aisle. He looks at the parents. Linoge.
You've made the right choice.
Molly turns away, sickened by the smiling monster's approval. Linoge sees her revulsion, and his smile broadens. He makes his way slowly down the center aisle, holding the bag of marbles out before him. He mounts the steps, and Robbie moves away from him rapidly, his face full of terror. Linoge stands by the podium, looking at his hostages with a kindly smile. Linoge.
You've done a hard thing, my friends, but despite what the constable may have told you, it's also a good thing, the right thing. The only thing, really, that loving, responsible people could have done under the circumstances.
He holds out the bag by the drawstring, so it hangs down from his hand.
Linoge. These are weirding stones. They were old when the world was young, and used to decide great issues long before Atlantis sank into the African Ocean. There are 7 white stones in here, and 1 black one.
Loge pauses, smiles, a smile that shows the tips of his fangs.
Loge, you're eager for me to be gone, and I don't blame you. Will 1 parent of each child come forward, please? Let's finish this up.
122. Interior. The Islanders. Realizing for the first time on a gut level what they have done. Realizing also that it's too late to turn back. 123. Interior. Linoge. Close up. Smiling. Showing the tips of his fangs. And holding out the bag. It's time to choose. Fade to black. This ends Act 5. Act 6. 124. Exterior, the Reach, night. The snow has stopped, and now moonlight beats a gilded track across the Reach toward the mainland. 125. Exterior, Main Street, night. Snow clogged and silent. 126. Exterior, the Town Hall, night. Dark on the right, brightly candlelit on the left where the meeting hall is. 127. Interior, the Meeting Hall, night. Slowly. Slowly, the parents come down the center aisle. Jill, Ursula, Jack, Linda, Sandra, Henry, and Melinda. At the rear of the group is Molly Anderson. She looks pleadingly at Mike. Molly.
Mike, please try to understand.
Mike, do you want me to understand? Go back and sit with him then. Refuse to take part in this obscenity. Molly.
I can't. If you could only see...
Mike is looking down between his legs at the floor. He doesn't want to look at her, doesn't want to look at any of it. She sees this and goes on sorrowfully up the steps. The parents range themselves in a line on the stage. Manoj looks at them with the benign smile of a dentist, assuring a child that this won't hurt, this won't hurt at all. Manoj,
it's perfectly simple. You each draw a stone from the bag. The child whose parent draws the black stone comes with me. To live long, see far, and know much. Mrs. Robichaud, Jill, would you start us, please?
He offers her the bag. At first, it seems she won't reach into it, or can't. Andy.
Go on, honey. Do it.
She gives him a haunted look, then reaches into the bag, feels around, and comes out with her hand tightly clasped around a stone. She looks as though she might faint. Linoge.
Mrs. Hatcher?
Melinda takes a stone. Sandra is next. She reaches toward the bag, then draws away. Sandra.
Robbie, I can't. You.
But Robbie doesn't want to be that near Linoge. Robbie.
Go on. Draw.
She does, and stands back, little mouth quivering, her hand clasped so tightly around the stone that the fingers are white. Next is Henry Bright. Feeling around a long time, rejecting one or two in favor of another. Then Jack. He chooses fast, then steps back and gives Angie a desperate, hopeful smile. Linda St. Pierre draws one. That leaves Ursula and Molly. Linoge.
Ladies.
Ursula.
You go first, Molly.
Molly.
No. Please. You.
Ursula plunges her hand into the bag, takes one of the 2 remaining stones, then steps back, fist clenched. Molly steps forward, looks at Linoge, and takes the last stone. Linoge tosses the empty bag aside. It flutters toward the stage, then disappears in a dim blue glow before it ever reaches the boards. No reaction from the Islanders. Their silence is so thick and tense you could cut it with a knife. Linoge.
All right, my friends. So far, it's done very well. Now, who has the courage to show first, to put fear aside and let sweet relief rush in to take its place?
No one responds. They stand, 8 parents with their hands clenched before them, each in utter white-faced terror. Linoge,
genial. Come, come. Have you never heard that the gods punish the faint-hearted?
Jack cries out,
Buster, I love you.
He opens his hand. The marble he holds is white. The audience murmurs. Ursula steps forward. She holds out her closed, trembling fist. She nerves herself up, and her hand springs open. This marble is also white. The audience murmurs again. Robbie.
Let's see, Sandra. Show it.
Sandra.
I... Robbie, I can't. I know it's Donnie. I know it is. I've never been lucky.
Impatient with her, contemptuous of her, in a frenzy to know one way or the other, he goes to her, seizes her hand, and pries the fingers open. We can't see, and at first we can read nothing from his face. Then he seizes what she holds and lifts it up so they can all see. He's grinning savagely. Looks like Richard Nixon at a political rally. Robbie.
White.
He tries to embrace his wife, but Sandra pushes him away with an expression beyond disgust. This is outright revulsion. Now it's Linda St. Pierre's turn to step forward. She holds out her closed hand, looking down at it, then closes her eyes. Linda St. Pierre.
Please, God, I beg of you, don't take my Heidi away.
She opens her hand, but not her eyes. Another voice.
White.
The audience murmurs. Linda opens her eyes, sees the stone is indeed white, and begins to weep, closing her hand again and holding the precious stone to her breast. Manoj.
Jill? Mrs. Robichaud?
Jill Robichaud.
I can't. I thought I could go through with it, but I can't. I'm sorry.
She heads for the stairs, still holding her clenched fist in front of her, before she can get there. Manoj points his cane her way. She is driven back at once. Manoj now dips the silver wolf's head at her hand. She tries to hold the fingers closed and can't. The stone drops to the stage, rolls like a marble, which is what the stones look like, and the camera tracks it. It finally stops, resting against one of the legs of the town manager's table. It's white. Jill collapses to her knees, sobbing. Linda helps her to her feet and embraces her. Now there is only Henry, Melinda, and Molly. One of them has the black stone. We intercut their spouses. Carla Bright and Hatch are watching the stage with passionate, terrorized fascination. Mike is still looking at the floor. Manoj.
Mr. Bright. Henry. Will you favor us?
Henry steps forward and slowly opens his hand. The stone is white. He all but deflates in his relief. Carla looks at him, smiling through her tears. Now it's down to Molly and Melinda, Ralphie and Pippa. The two mothers look at each other with Linoge smiling in the background. One of them is about to cease being a mother, and both of them know it. 128. Interior. Molly. Close up. She's imagining. 129. Exterior. Blue sky. Day. Flying high above the clouds is Linoge, but now the V is very short. Of the eight children, only Ralphie and Pippa are left, each gripping one of Linoge's hands. 130. Interior. Resume stage. Night. Linoge.
Ladies.
Molly looks a thought at Melinda. Melinda catches it and nods slightly. The women hold out their closed fists, hand to hand. They look at each other, frantic with love, hope, and fear. Molly. Very soft.
Now.
131. Interior. The closed hands close up. They open. In one is a white marble, in the other is a black. There are murmurs, gasps, and cries of surprise from the audience, but we can't tell. Not yet. We only see the stones lying on the open palms. 132. Interior. Molly's face. Extreme close-up. Wide eyes. 133. Interior. Melinda's face. Extreme close-up. Wide eyes. 134. Interior. Hatch's face. Extreme close-up. Wide eyes. 135. Interior. Mike. Extreme close-up. Head down, but he can't keep it that way, despite his intention not to participate in this, even passively. He raises his face and looks toward the stage. And we must read the loss of his son first on this man's face. We see incredulity. Then the dawn of a terrible understanding. Mike, to his feet.
No. No!
Sonny, Lucien, and Alex grab him when he tries to lunge forward and wrestle him back to his seat. 136. Interior. Molly and Melinda on stage. They continue to face each other, almost forehead to forehead. Frozen, their hands, now open, held out. In Melinda's is the seventh white stone. In Molly's is the black one. Melinda's face breaks in delayed reaction. She turns, blinded by tears, and walks toward the edge of the stage. Melinda.
Teppa, Mommy's coming, love.
She stumbles on the stairs and would go headlong if not for Hatch, who was there to catch her. Melinda, hysterical with relief, doesn't even notice. She fights free of her husband's arms and runs up the center aisle. Melinda.
Teppa, honey, it's all right. Mommy's coming, sweetheart. Mommy's coming.
Hatch turns to Mike. Hatch.
Mike, I...
Mike only looks at him, a look of pure, poisonous hate.
You condoned this, and it has cost me my son,
that look says. Hatch cannot bear it. He goes after his wife, almost slinking. Molly has been stunned through all of this, looking down at the black marble, but now she begins to realize what has happened. Molly.
No. Oh, no. This isn't... This can't be.
She throws the stone away and turns to Linoge. Molly.
It's a joke. Or a test. It's a test, isn't it? You didn't really mean...
But he did really mean it. Does really mean it. And she sees that. Molly.
You can't have him.
Linoge.
Molly, I feel your grief keenly, but you agreed to the terms. I'm sorry.
Molly.
You fixed it somehow. You wanted him all along. Because of the fairy saddle.
Is this true? We will never know if we imagined the flicker in Linoge's eyes or actually saw it. Linoge.
I assure you that's not so. The game, as you'd say, was straight. And since I believe that long, drawn-out farewells only add to the pain...
He starts toward the stairs, on the way to claim his prize. Molly.
No. No, I won't let you.
She tries to attack him. Linoge gestures with the cane, and she is flung backward, hitting the town manager's table and rolling over it. She lands in a sobbing heap on the floor. Linoge, at the lip of the stage and the top of the stairs, regards the islanders, who look like people waking up from a communal nightmare in which they have done some terrible, irrevocable thing, with beaming, sardonic pleasure. Linoge.
Ladies and gentlemen, residents of Littletall, I thank you for your attention to my needs, and I declare this meeting at an end, with a suggestion that the less you say to the outside world about our arrangement, the more happy you are apt to be, although such matters are... Of course, ultimately up to you.
Behind his back, Molly gets to her feet and comes forward. She looks all but insane with shock, grief, and incredulity. Linoge pulls on gloves, watch cap.
With that, I'll take my new protege and leave you to your thoughts. May they be happy ones.
He starts down the stairs. His path to the center aisle brings him close to where Mike sits. Molly rushes forward to the edge of the stage, her eyes so big they seem to fill the whole top half of her face. She sees that Mike's guards are no longer doing their job. Lucien, Sonny, and the others are sitting back, looking at Linoge, their jaws agape. Molly, shrieking,
Mike, stop him! For God's sake, stop him!
Mike knows what will happen if he goes for Linoge. A single wave of the cane, and he will be peeling himself off one of the walls. He looks up at his wife, his estranged wife now, one supposes. With horrible dead eyes. Mike.
Too late, Molly.
She reacts first with dismay, then with crazed determination. If Mike will not help her right the mistake they've made, she will do it herself. She looks around and sees Robbie's little pistol, now lying on the podium. She seizes it, whirls, and plunges down the steps to the floor. Molly.
Stop. I'm warning you.
Linoge sweeps on, and a change is taking place as he walks. The peacoat is becoming a robe of royal silver blue, decorated with suns and moons and other symbols of cabalistic design. The watch cap is becoming the tall, pointed hat of a sorcerer or wizard, and the cane is becoming a scepter. The wolf's head is still there, but now it tops a glowing wand worthy of Merlin. Molly either doesn't see or doesn't care. All she wants to do is to stop him. She steps to the head of the center aisle and levels the pistol. Molly.
Stop or I'll shoot.
But Sonny and Alex Haber crowd into the aisle, blocking her off from Lenoge. Lucien and Johnny Harriman grab her, and Hatch plucks the gun neatly from her hand. During all this, Mike only sits with his head down, unable to look. Lucien.
Sorry, Mrs. Anderson, but we made a deal. Molly.
We didn't understand the deal. We didn't understand what we were doing. Mike was right. We didn't... Jack, stop him. Don't let him take Ralphie. Don't let him take my son.
Jack.
I can't do that, Molly. Then, with some resentment. And you wouldn't be screaming like that either if it had been me with the black marble.
She looks at him, unbelieving. He holds her eyes for a moment, then wavers. But Angela is there to put her arm around him, and Angie looks at Molly with bright hostility. Angie.
Can't you be a good loser?
Molly.
This isn't a baseball game?
137. Interior. The kid's corner with Lenoge. He is now a wizard from head to toe, wrapped in a bright blue aura. We once more see his great age. The other parents and friends surrounding the sleeping children draw back from him in fear. He pays them absolutely no notice. He bends down, picks Ralphie Anderson up in his arms, and gazes at the boy raptly. 138. Interior, the foot of the center aisle, with Molly. In her hysteria, she almost succeeds in struggling free from the big men holding her. She faces Lenoge along the length of the aisle with hysterical defiance. Molly.
You tricked us.
Lenoge.
Perhaps you tricked yourselves.
Molly.
They'll never belong to you. Never.
Lenoge lifts the sleeping boy up like an offering. The blue glow around him intensifies, and now it begins to steal over Ralphie as well. Lenoge's age is not kindly, but cruel. A thing to be feared, and his smile is horrible in its triumph, a thing to haunt our dreams. Lenoge.
But he will. He'll come to love me.
Pause.
He'll come to call me father.
There is an awful truth to this, against which Molly cannot hold out. She slumps in the hands holding her back, ceasing to resist. Lenoge holds her gaze a moment longer, then turns, the hem of his silk robe flaring out. He strides for the door. Everyone turns to watch him. 139. Interior. Mike. He gets up. That dead look is still on his face. Hatch reaches for him. Hatch.
Mike, I don't think...
Mike pushes his hand off. Don't touch me. Don't ever touch me again. Not any of you. Looks at Molly. Not any of you. He walks up the side aisle. No one stops him. 140. Interior. The corridor of the town hall. Mike steps out of the meeting hall just in time to see the hem of Lenoge's robe going out the front door and into the night. He pauses, then goes after. 141. Exterior. The front steps of the town hall. Night. Mike comes out and stands looking, his breath puffing silver in the moonlight. 142. Exterior. Lenoge and Ralphie in front of the town hall. Night. Lenoge is still glowing bright blue. The camera tracks with him as he carries Ralphie down the slope toward the street, the shore, the reach, the mainland, and all the leagues of earth beyond. We see Lenoge's tracks, first quite heavy, then light, then just faint prints. As Lenoge passes the cupola with the memorial bell inside, he begins rising into the air, only an inch or two at first, but the distance between him and the earth is growing. It's almost as if he's climbing stairs we can't see. 143. Exterior. Mike, on the town hall steps. Night. He cries out after his son, putting all his grief and loss into that one shouted word. Mike.
Ralphie!
144. Exterior. Lenoge and Ralphie. Night. Ralphie opens his eyes and looks around. Ralphie.
Where am I? Where's my daddy?
Mike. Voice, growing faint.
Ralphie!
Lenoge.
It doesn't matter, fairy saddle boy. Look down.
Ralphie looks down. They are flying over the reach now. Their shadows flee across the waves, etched in moonlight. Ralphie smiles, delighted. Ralphie.
Whoa! Neat!
Pause.
Is it real?
Linoge.
Real as rhubarb.
Ralphie looks back at 145. Exterior, little tall island, from Ralphie's point of view, night. This is almost a negative image of our introduction to the island, night instead of day, going away instead of approaching. In the moonlight, little tall looks almost like an illusion, which, to Ralphie, it will soon be. 146. Exterior, resume, Linoge and Ralphie, night. Ralphie, very impressed.
Where are we going?
Linoge tosses his scepter into the air ahead of him. It rises and resumes the position it held in the visions of Linoge and the flying children. Its shadow, now thrown by the moon instead of by the sun, lies across Linoge's face. He bends and kisses the fairy saddle on Ralphie's nose. Linoge.
Anywhere. Everywhere. All the places you ever dreamed of.
Ralphie.
What about my mom and dad? When are they coming?
Linoge, smiling.
Why don't we worry about them later?
Well, he's the grown-up, and besides, this is fun. Ralphie.
Okay.
Linoge turns, banks like an airplane almost, and flies away from us. 147. Exterior. Mike on the town hall step. Night. He's weeping. Joanna Stanhope comes out and puts a hand on his shoulder. She speaks to him with infinite kindness. Joanna.
Mike, come in.
He ignores her, going down the steps and stumbling his way into the new snow. It's tough going for folks who aren't wizards, but he flounders ahead just the same, even though it's waist deep at times. He follows Linoge's footprints, and the camera tracks with him, watching as the impressions grow lighter and lighter, less and less tied to the earth where mortals must live. Past the memorial bell, there is one more faint imprint than nothing. Just acres of virgin snow. Mike collapses beside that last print, crying. He holds his hands up to the empty sky, the glowing moon. Mike, low. Bring him back. Please. I'll do anything if you bring my son back. Anything you want. 148. Exterior, the doors to the town hall, night. They are crowded with islanders who stand there, silently watching. Johnny and Sonny, Ferd and Lucien, Tavia and Della, Hatch and Melinda. Mike, pleading voice. Bring him back! The faces of the islanders do not change. We may see sympathy, but we will see no mercy. Not here. Not among these. What's done is done. 149. Exterior. Resume, Mike, on the snowfield, night. He huddles in the snow beyond the cupola holding the memorial bell, holds his arms out to the moon and the light-drenched water one final time, but without hope. Mike whispers,
please, bring him back.
The camera begins to pull up and away. Little by little, Mike loses his human dimension and becomes just a black speck on a vast white snowfield. Beyond is the headland, the tumbled lighthouse, and the waves of the reach. Fade to black. Mike. Voice. A final whispered plea.
I love him. Have mercy.
This ends Act 6. Act 7. 150. Exterior. The reach. A summer morning. The sky is bright blue, and so is the reach. Fishing boats chug stolidly. Pleasure boats dash, dragging wakes and whooping water skiers. Overhead, gulls swoop and cry. 151. Exterior. A seacoast town. Morning. Title card. Machias. Summer of 1989. 152. Exterior. A small, clapboard building on Main Street. Morning. The sign out front reads, Seacoast Counseling Services. And below this, there is a solution. We'll find it together. The camera moves in on a side window. A woman sits there looking out. Her eyes are red, her cheeks wet with tears. Her hair is gray, and at first we do not recognize Molly Anderson. She has aged 20 years. 153. Interior, the counselor's office, morning. Molly sits in a bentwood rocker, looking out at summer and crying soundlessly. Sitting across from her is her counselor, a professional woman, in a light cream-colored summer skirt and silk summer blouse, nicely coiffed, nicely turned out, and looking at Molly with that kind of sympathy good psychologists show, often helpful but scary in its distance. The silence spins out. The counselor is waiting for Molly to break it, but Molly only sits in the rocker, looking out at summer with her streaming eyes. Counselor.
You and Mike haven't slept together in how long?
Molly, looking out the window.
5 months, give or take.
I could tell you exactly if you thought it would help. The last time was the night before the big storm came. The storm of the century.
Counselor. When you lost your son.
Molly.
Correct. When I lost my son.
Counselor.
And Mike blames you for that loss.
Molly.
I think he's going to leave me.
Counselor.
You're very afraid of that, aren't you?
Molly.
I think he's running out of ways to stay. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Counselor.
Tell me again what happened to Ralphie.
Molly.
Why? What good will it do? For God's sake, what good can it do? He's gone.
The counselor makes no response. After a bit, Molly sighs and gives in.
Molly. It was the second day. We were in the town hall where we took shelter, you know? The storm. You can't believe how bad it was.
Counselor.
I was here. I went through it.
Molly.
Yes, you were here, Lisa, on the mainland. It's different on the island.
Pause.
Everything's different on the island.
Pause.
Anyway, Johnny Harriman came rushing in while we were having breakfast and said the lighthouse was going over. Everyone wanted to see, of course. And Mike...
154. Exterior, the Anderson house. Summer morning. There's a small white car at the curb with the trunk lid up. There are two or three suitcases in it. Now the door opens and Mike comes out carrying two more. He closes the door, descends the porch steps, and goes down the walk. Every motion and gesture, every look back, tells us that this is a man who is leaving for good.
Molly,
voiceover.
Mike told us it was whiteout, and to stay close to the building. Ralphie wanted to see. Pippa and all the kids wanted to go out and see, and so we took them. God help us, we took them.
Mike stops by the Wee Folks daycare sign. It's still chain-hung from a low branch of the yard maple, but now it looks dusty somehow. Forgotten. Of no importance. Mike yanks it down, looks at it, then turns and throws it back at the porch, momentarily furious.
Molly.
Voiceover.
It was a mistake for any of us to go out, especially the children. We underestimated the storm. Several people wandered away and were lost. Ralphie was one of them. Angie Carver found her way back. None of the others did.
Mike looks at the porch where the sign has landed, then turns and walks down to his car. He puts the last couple of bags in and slams the trunk. As he starts around to the driver's side, digging the keys out of his pocket.
Hatch,
voice.
Mike?
Mike turns. Hatch, looking strange in a T-shirt and Bermuda shorts, walks up to where he stands. He looks painfully unhappy to be here. Mike looks back at him coolly.
Mike,
if you've got something to say, best say it. Ferry leaves at 11:10, and I don't intend to miss it.
Hatch, where are you going?
Silence from Mike.
Don't, Michael. Don't leave.
Silence from Mike.
Would it do any good to tell you I haven't had a decent night's sleep since February?
No answer from Mike.
Would it do any good to tell you that
we might have been wrong?
Mike.
Hatch, I have to get going.
Hatch.
Robbie says to tell you the constable's job is yours again whenever you want it. All you have to do is ask.
Mike.
Tell him where he can park his job. I'm done here. I've tried until I can't try anymore. He starts for the driver's door, and just before he swings in, Hatch touches his arm. Mike whirls at that touch. Eyes burning, as if he means to punch Hatch's lights out. But Hatch doesn't flinch. Maybe he thinks he deserves it.
Hatch.
Molly needs you. Have you seen the way she is now? Have you even looked?
Mike, you look for me, okay?
Hatch drops his eyes.
Melly isn't doing very well either. She takes a lot of tranquilizers. I think she might be hooked on them.
Mike, too bad, but you've got your daughter at least. You may not sleep so well, but you can go into Pippa's bedroom and watch her sleep any night you want, can't you?
Hatch, you're as self-righteous as ever. Can't see it any way but your way.
Mike swings behind the wheel and looks bleakly up at Hatch.
Mike, I'm not anything. I'm empty, scooped out as a gourd in November.
Hatch,
if you could just try to understand.
Mike, I understand that the ferry leaves at 11:10, and if I don't get moving now, I'm going to miss it.
Good luck, Hatch. Hope you catch up on your sleep.
He slams the car door, starts the engine, and pulls out onto Main Street.
Hatch helplessly watches him go.
155. Exterior, the lawn of the town hall. Morning. The camera looks down toward Main Street and picks up Mike's car, heading toward the docks where the Inter-Island Ferry is backed up, engine rumbling. We hold for a moment, then pan left, to the cupola and the memorial bell. A second plaque has been added to the right of the war dead. Heading it is this: those lost in the storm of the century, 1989. Below are the names Martha Clarendon, Peter Godso, William Soames, Lloyd Wishman, Cora Stanhope, Jane Kingsbury, William Timmons, George Kirby, and, at the very bottom, Ralph Anderson. The camera moves in on his name. 156. Interior, the counselor's office. Morning. Molly has stopped talking and just looks out the window. Fresh tears well in her eyes and spill down her cheeks, but her weeping remains silent. Counselor.
Molly?
Molly.
He wandered away into the whiteout. Maybe he wound up with Bill Timmons, the gas station man. I like to think so, that he was with somebody at the end. They must have lost their bearings completely and gone into the water. They were the two who were never found.
Counselor.
There's a great deal of this story you haven't told me, isn't there?
Silence from Molly.
Until you do, until you tell someone, it will keep festering.
Molly.
It will fester no matter what I do. Some wounds can never be cleaned out. I didn't understand that before, but now I do.
Counselor.
Why does your husband hate you so, Molly? What really happened to Ralphie?
Camera moves in on Molly. She is still looking out the window. It's sunny in the counselor's yard. The grass is green, and there are flowers, but it's snowing. The snow falls thickly, coating the grass and the walks, keeping on the leafy branches of the trees. We move in on Molly, move into extreme close-up as she looks out on the falling snow.
Molly.
He wandered away. People do, you know. They get lost. That's what happened to Ralphie. He was lost in the whiteout. He was lost in the storm.
Dissolve to 157. Exterior. The ferry. Morning. It's trudging its way across the reach to Machias. The cars are parked on the apron at the back, Mike's among them. Mike himself stands alone at the rail, his face up, the ocean breeze blowing his hair back from his forehead. He looks almost at peace.
Mike, voiceover.
9 years ago, that was. I just gassed my car and left on the 11:10 ferry. I've never been back.
Dissolve to 158. Interior. The counselor's office. Morning.
Molly's session is over. The clock on the wall reads 11:55. She stands at the counselor's desk writing a check. The counselor looks at her with a troubled expression, knowing that she is lost, and once again, the island has won. The secret, whatever it is, has been kept.
Neither of them sees Mike's little white car go by.
Mike, voiceover.
I didn't think about where I was going at first. I just drove.
159. Exterior. Mike, through the windshield of his car, sunset. He's wearing dark glasses against the bright orange glow. Reflected in each lens is a setting sun.
Mike, voiceover.
All I cared about was that I had to wear sunglasses every night when the sun went down.
that every mile on the odometer was a mile further away from Little Tall. 160. Exterior, the American desert, midday. Two-lane blacktop runs through the middle of the frame. The white car enters, moving fast, and the camera swings to follow. Mike, voiceover. The divorce was no fault. Mal got the bank accounts, the insurance, the store, the house, and a little piece of land we had in Vanceboro. I got the Toyota and the peace of mind. Pause. What was left of it? 161. Exterior. The Golden Gate Bridge. Twilight. Mike. Voiceover. I wound up here. Back on the water again. Ironic, I guess, huh? But it's different somehow. The Pacific. It doesn't have that hard glow when the days start to run down toward winter. Pause. And it doesn't have the same memories. 162. Exterior. A skyscraper on Montgomery Street, San Francisco. Day. Mike comes out. An older Mike, with gray at his temples and lines on his face, but one who looks as if he's made his peace with the world, or found some. He wears a suit, casual, no tie, and carries a briefcase. He and the man with him walk to a sedan parked at the curb. It pulls out into traffic, swinging around a cable car. Over this, Mike talks. Mike, voiceover. I went back to school. Got a degree in law enforcement and another one in accountancy. Thought about going after a law degree, and then thought again. Started out keeping store on an island off the main coast and wound up a federal marshal. How do you like that? 163. Exterior. Mike, through the windshield. Day. His partner is driving. Mike sits quietly in the shotgun seat, his eyes distant. It's the look of a man visiting along memory lane. Mike. Voiceover. Sometimes the island seems very far away, and Andre Lenoge just a bad dream I had. Sometimes when I wake up late at night trying not to scream, it seems very close. And as I said way back at the beginning, I keep in touch. 164. Exterior. The Little Tall Graveyard. Day. Mourners move between the gravestones toward a newly dug grave bearing a coffin. We see this from the middle distance. Fall leaves rush past in rattling bursts of color. Mike, voiceover. Melinda Hatcher died in October of 1990. The local paper said it was a heart attack. Ursula Gatso sent me the clipping. I don't know if there was more to it or not. 35's young for your pump to quit, but it happens. Yeah. Sure, dear. 165. Exterior, the Little Tall Methodist Church. Day. It's late spring. Cheerful flowers shout color along the walk leading from the front door. Faintly, we can hear the triumphal organ strains of the wedding march. The door is burst open. Out comes Molly, laughing and radiant in her wedding dress. There are still lines on her face, but her graying hair is hidden. Beside her, dressed in a morning coat and clasping her waist, is Hatch. He looks as happy as she does. Behind them, holding up Molly's train with one hand and clutching a bouquet in the other, is Pippa, now bigger and with beautiful long hair. Her days of getting her head stuck between the banister posts are pretty well behind her. People follow, flinging rice. Among them, smiling like a proud papa, is Reverend Bob Riggins. Mike, voiceover. Molly and Hatch married in May of 93. Ursula sent me that clipping, too. From what I hear, they have been good for each other. And for Pippa. I'm glad. I wish the three of them every happiness. I mean that with all my heart. 166. Interior. A cheesy rented room. Night. Mike. Voiceover. Not everyone from Little Tall's been so lucky. The camera tracks across the room, past a rumpled, unmade bed that looks like it has seen its share of bad dreams. The bathroom door is ajar, and the camera pushes through. Mike, voiceover. Jack and Angie Carter divorced about 2 months after Hatch and Molly got married. Jack fought for custody of Buster. It was pretty bitter, I guess, and lost. He moved off-island to Lewiston, rented a room, and killed himself there one night in the late summer of 1994. The bathroom window is open. Through it, faintly, We can hear the sound of a barb end lashing its way through Hang-On Sloopy. Jack Carver is lying in a dry bathtub with a plastic bag pulled down over his head. The camera moves in relentlessly until we can see the paisley eye patch over one eye. Mike, voiceover. He left what little he had to a fellow named Harmon Brodsky, who lost an eye in a barroom fight back in the 80s. 167. Exterior, Little Tall Island, from The Reach, morning. It's still, except for the slow toll of a bell buoy, and a little ghostly, misted in shades of gray. We can see that the town dock has been rebuilt, and there's a fish warehouse there as well, only it's a different color from Peter's, and the sign along the side reads Beale's Fancy Fish instead of Godso Fish and Lobster. Now, as the camera begins to pull back, we also hear the lap of water against the side of a boat. It comes into view, a small rowboat riding on the swell. During this, Mike, voiceover. Robbie Beals rebuilt the old fish house on the town dock and hired Kirk Freeman to work there. Kirk said Robbie's wife Sandra came down there one early morning in the spring of 1996, dressed in her yellow slicker and red boots, and told him she wanted to go for a little row. Kirk made her put on a life preserver. He said he didn't like the way she looked. The camera reaches the boat and rises, showing us the prow. Neatly folded there is a yellow fisherman's slicker. A pair of red galoshes stand beside it, and placed around their toes like a collar is a Mae West. Mike, voiceover. He said it was like she was dreaming with her eyes open. But what could he do? It was a mild morning, no wind, not much of a swell, and she was the boss's wife. They found the boat, but they didn't find Sandy. There was one strange thing. Camera slips along the length of the boat. Written across the rear seat, in either red paint or lipstick, is a single word, Croatan. Mike, voiceover. But they didn't know what to make of it. There were people on the island who maybe could have helped them a little there. 168. Interior, the town office with Ursula, day. A couple of state policemen are talking to her. We don't need to hear them. This can be MOS without sound, no doubt asking questions, and she is shaking her head politely. Sorry, officers, nope, can't imagine, and so on. Mike, voiceover. But island folk can keep a secret. We kept our share back in 1989, and the people who live there keep them still. As for Sandra Beals, she is presumed drowned, and her 7 years are up in 2003. Robbie will no doubt have her declared officially dead as soon as 03 comes around on the calendar. Tough, I know, but... 169. Exterior, Little Tall Island, from the ocean, day. Mike, voiceover, continues. This is a cash-and-carry world. Pay as you go. Sometimes you only have to pay a little, but mostly it's a lot. And once in a while, it's all you have. That's a lesson I thought I learned 9 years ago on Little Tall, during the storm of the century. Slow dissolve to 170. Exterior, San Francisco, stock shot, day. Mike, voiceover. But I was wrong. I only started learning during the big blow. I finished just last week. 171. Exterior, a busy downtown street, day. Lots of folks are shopping. We move in on an upscale deli, one or two storefronts up from the corner, and Mike comes out. It's his day off, and he's dressed casually, light jacket, jeans, and a t-shirt. He's got a couple of shopping bags in his arms, and he juggles them, trying to snag his keys out of his pants pocket as he angles toward the curb and his car. Coming in the other direction, entering the frame with their backs to us, are a man and a teenage boy. The man is dressed in a gray topcoat and Homburg hat. He carries a cane with a silver wolf's head. The boy with him is wearing an Oakland A's jacket and jeans. Mike will pass them on the way to his car, but he takes no particular notice of them at first. He's gotten his keys out. Now he's trying to peer at them over one of his bags just enough so he can see which one will unlock the door. Then, just as the man and teenage boy reach Mike, Minogue sings.
I'm a little teapot, short and stout.
Boy, joining in.
Here is my handle. Here is my spout.
Mike's face fills with terrible recognition. The keys fall from his fingers, and the shopping bags sag in his arms as he turns and sees. 172. Exterior. Linoge and the boy, from Mike's point of view. Slow motion. Day. They are already passing Mike, and there's only time for a glimpse, even in slow motion. Yes, it's Linoge beneath the Homburg, now looking not like a psychotic fisherman, but like a ruthless businessman, and not 35, but 65. The boy with him, smiling up at him and harmonizing prettily on the well-loved old nonsense jingle, is a handsome child of 14. His hair is Molly's shade. His eyes are Mike's shade. And lying across his nose, faint but still visible, is the fairy saddle birthmark. Linoge and Ralphie, echoing dreamlike voices. You can pick me up and pour me out. I'm a little teapot, short and stout. During this, we lose our angle on their faces, which we have seen for only that heartbreakingly brief moment anyway. Now, they are only a pair of backs, a well-dressed man, and the child of his late middle age, heading for the corner. And, beyond the corner, for anywhere. 173. Exterior. Resume, Mike. Day. He stands where he is, bags sagging in his arms, thunderstruck. His mouth opens and closes soundlessly, and then, at last, a whisper comes out. Mike.
Ralphie!
174. Exterior. Linoge and Ralphie. Day. They are beyond the deli, almost to the corner. They stop and look back. 175. Exterior. Resume. Mike. Day. He drops the bags from his arms. Stuff inside smashes and runs. Mike.
Ralphie!
176. Exterior. Linoge and Ralphie. Day. Ralphie's mouth opens. He hisses like a snake. His good looks are gone in an instant as the fangs beneath his lips are revealed. His eyes darken and become black, shot through with writhing red lines. He raises hands that are hooked into talons as if to claw Mike's face open. Linoge puts an arm around his shoulders and, without taking his eyes away from Mike, urges Ralph to turn. Then they sweep around the corner together. 177. Exterior. Resume Mike. Day. He stops outside the deli, his face filled with dismay and sickened horror. Pedestrians stream around him, some looking at him curiously, but Mike takes no notice. Mike.
Ralphie.
He dashes for the corner and goes around. 178. Exterior. Mike. Day. He comes to a stop, eyes searching. 179. Exterior. The street, from Mike's point of view. Day. People come and go on the sidewalks, or dart across the street, or hail taxis, or get newspapers from curbside vending machines. There is no man in a gray topcoat. There is no boy in an Oakland A's jacket. 180. Exterior. Resume, Mike. Linoge. Voiceover.
He'll come to love me.
Pause.
He'll come to call me father.
Mike slumps against the wall and closes his eyes. From beneath one of those closed lids, a single tear slips. A young woman comes around the corner and looks at him with cautious sympathy. Young woman.
Mister, are you all right?
Mike doesn't open his eyes. Yes, I just need a minute. Young woman.
You dropped your groceries. Some of it's probably okay, but some of the stuff broke.
Mike now opens his eyes and does his best to smile at her. Mike.
Yeah, some of the stuff broke. I heard it.
Young woman, smiling.
What kind of accent is that?
Mike. The kind you learn on the other side of the world. Young woman.
What happened? Did you trip?
Mike. I thought I saw someone I knew, and I just kind of lost my grip for a second there. He looks down the street one more time. He reached the corner seconds after Linoge and Ralphie turned it. They should be right there, but they're not. And Mike isn't really surprised. Young woman.
I could help you pick up the stuff that's still okay if you wanted. Look, I got this.
She reaches into her coat pocket and brings out a crumpled-up net shopping bag. She holds it out to him, smiling tentatively. Mike, that would be very kind. They go around the corner together. 181. Exterior. Mike and the young woman. A high angle, day. As they approach his car and the spilled groceries, we see them from above. Then, boom higher yet, turning and losing them. Now, we see the bright blue sky and water of San Francisco Bay, with the bridge spanning it like a dream that has begun to rust a little around the edges. There are swooping gulls. We track one of them. We dissolve to 182. Exterior. Swooping gull. Day. We follow it, then boom down to discover a little tall island and the town hall. There's a car parked at the curb. Three people walk toward the cupola that holds the plaques and the memorial bell. One, a woman, walks ahead of the other two. Mike, voiceover. I could have written Molly and told her. I thought about it. I even prayed about it. When every choice hurts, how do you tell which one's the right one? In the end, I kept silent. Sometimes, mostly late at night when I can't sleep, I think that was wrong. But in daylight, I know better. 183. Exterior. The cupola on the town hall lawn. Day. Molly approaches it slowly. In her hands, she has a bouquet of flowers. Her face is serene and sad and quite beautiful. Behind her, Hatch and Pippa stand at the edge of the grass, Hatch with his arm around his daughter's shoulders. Molly kneels at the base of the plaque commemorating those lost in the storm of the century. She puts her flowers at the base of this plaque. She is crying a little now. She kisses her fingers, then presses them to her son's name. She gets up and walks back to where Hatch and Pippa wait. Hatch puts his arms around her and hugs her. 184. Exterior. Little tall island. Long. Day. Mike. Voiceover. In daylight, I know better. Fade to black. End of Storm of the Century by Stephen King.